Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents Progress Toward Global Food Security, UN Development Goals for the Millennium by Catherine Bertini, United Nations Undersecretary General for Management, on Thursday, February 3rd at 4 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580 Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. Our topic this afternoon is the U.S. Supreme Court, specifically the court under Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Our guest is Georgetown University law professor Mark Tushnet. Professor Tushnet has written a book about the Rehnquist Court's 18-year record. The title, A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. When it comes to thinking about the court's divisions, many of us will think conservative and liberal. But Tushnet says the real division on the court has been between two types of Republicans. In his introduction, Mark Tushnet says this, "The civics book view of the court, that conservative and liberal justices divide over whether it should be restrained or activist, and that they use original intent or contemporary values in interpretation, is a fairy tale. Nothing like it goes on in the Rehnquist Court. Everyone is a judicial activist." Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. Your questions and comments are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Professor Tushnet, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
The split between conservatives on the court, is it anything like the same kind of split we've seen in the Republican Party in Illinois?
I'm not entirely sure about the Illinois situation, but the split on the court does mirror something that's been happening in the National Republican Party. I describe the split as between modern Republicans, who are the heirs to the Goldwater, Reagan, Gingrich tradition, and traditional Republicans, who are more Northeastern or Rockefeller or Country Club Republicans. And actually, I used John Paul Stevens, who's from Illinois, as one of the traditional Republicans.
Okay. Here in Illinois, just to follow up a little bit here, and then I'll move on, that we saw this split in the Illinois GOP most recently and most divisively in the campaign for the U.S. Senate, where we saw Alan Keyes, a conservative Republican, brought in to run against Barack Obama.
Right, and Keyes would be somebody I'd describe as a modern Republican, and to the extent that there is division in the party, I suspect it would be that more traditional Republicans were uncomfortable with him.
Okay, and you're saying modern Republican, not moderate Republican.
Right, sorry, yes, new breed, I'll use new breed.
Yeah, I just want our listeners to know where we are.
Right. New breed Republican.
Yeah, okay. How is it that when we think of judicial activism, we think liberal judicial activism?
The reason is that starting during the Warren Court period in the 1960s, conservatives who were opposed to the decisions characterized them as activists, and it became a term of criticism and a way of chastising the Supreme Court for making liberal decisions. To the extent that it has any content independent of the idea of liberal decisions, it is finding statutes unconstitutional where the words of the Constitution and the original understanding don't clearly say that the statute's unconstitutional. Now, that kind of activism did characterize the Warren Court, but it also characterizes a certain kind of conservative decision that has been made by the Rehnquist Court.
Now, would you give us a couple of examples of some of the cases where the court has been most activist?
Sure. Although I have to say initially that these are one of the things about the Rehnquist Court is that it's been a liberal activist court on social issues like abortion and gay rights, which attract a lot of public attention, and a conservative activist on sort of economic regulation issues, which tend not to attract the same kind of public attention. With that as a background, an example of conservative activism is or a series of decisions saying that when local governments adopt environmental regulations that severely affect what you can do with your property, you can't build on a beachfront, or you have to exchange some property in order to get a building permit. When local governments do that, it's what's called a taking under the Constitution, and the governments have to pay for the deprivation of the property right. Now, the takings clause, when it was originally written, clearly didn't cover anything other than the government coming in and taking your property away from you, like eminent domain is the term we now use. But the conservatives have used this doctrine to restrict the ability of local governments to promote environmental and smart growth regulations.
Okay. And maybe you give us, is there another kind of example that you could give us as well?
The other major area in which the conservative activism has occurred is the area of federalism, meaning here how expansive are Congress's powers. For generations, at least since 1937 and probably before that, the court had interpreted the provisions of the Constitution giving Congress the power to act to give Congress extremely broad power on the basis of what the court sometimes acknowledges to be nothing written into the Constitution. The Rehnquist Court has said, no, here are some limits to what Congress can do. It can't make states compensate people for discriminating against them on the basis of disability, for example. It can't enact a statute authorizing women who are assaulted to sue in federal court. Those are the kinds of limits that the Rehnquist Court has imposed without having, and the justices acknowledge this, without having clear language in the U.S. Constitution saying Congress can't do that.
No. It seems to me that's a very activist kind of thing to do, to tell another branch of government what it can and cannot do.
Right. Now, of course, you know, if we have a constitution and we have judicial review, the whole point of it is to tell the courts to let the courts tell legislatures, no, here's something you can't do. So invalidating statutes is not, is what judicial review is all about. The question of activism is what's the basis for that invalidation? And again, if there were clear language in the Constitution, then it wouldn't be much of a problem. But it's always the case that the Constitution written in general language, and so you're going to have to go beyond the words. Conservatives are willing to do it just as much as liberals are in the service of the values they think most important.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things you say in this book is the politics of judicial, you phrase it in terms of nominations. The politics of judicial nominations is politics, but also it seems that the politics of the judiciary is politics.
Well, that's right. I mean, and there are two parts of it. Let me talk about the politics of the judiciary as politics. One of the things that political scientists and historians who study the court observe, and it's just an observation, is that you never find the Supreme Court getting very far out of line with what's happening in the rest of the political system. If you have, as we did in the New Deal or the Great Society period, strong control of Congress and the presidency by liberal Democrats, you'll have a Supreme Court that is promoting the kinds of constitutional vision that that Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson had. If you have a unified Republican government, as we may be getting now, then you can expect the Supreme Court to be promoting the kind of new breed Republican constitutional vision that's associated with, say, Newt Gingrich or Ronald Reagan.
Does this explain or help to explain, you know, the cases that the court decides to hear?
Well, it certainly affects what the justices think is important enough to spend their time on. Most of the time, they actually grant review in, obviously, in a relatively small number of cases. They get thousands of applications for review and decide now these years, 80 cases a year, roughly. Ordinarily, what they do is say, is this an important issue that affects people all over the country? And is it an issue on which the lower courts are divided? Need some guidance. If the lower courts are giving the same decision all the time, then you don't need to intervene. And if it's only a local issue, it's not worth spending the court's time on. An example of that latter thing is something that your listeners may have read about earlier this week. The court refused to hear the case brought by Governor Jeb Bush in Florida seeking review of a decision by the Florida Supreme Court striking down this Terry Schiavo's law. And the reason the court didn't hear it is that it's a unique statute. No, it doesn't exist or nothing like it exists anywhere else in the country, and it's not worth making law about.
Yeah. Also, we had a guest some time back, and I don't recall the guest's name, but I believe she was a journalist and observer of the Supreme Court, and she had a theory that she doesn't see that the court will take a case the first time it's out there. In other words, she says that she didn't think that the Pledge of Allegiance case that was out there earlier, last year I guess it was, they wouldn't accept it because it was the first time out, and the issue had to do with the standing of the person bringing forth the complaint.
And generally, that's right, that if there's only one decision, it ordinarily is not going to have national significance. But there are cases that attract public attention, like the Pledge of Allegiance case, or like last year's terrorism cases that are so clearly important that even if it's the first time the issue has come up, the court thinks that it's necessary to give constitutional guidance to the lower courts in the rest of the country.
Okay. Our guest this afternoon, Georgetown University law professor Mark Tushnet, and he is the author of A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're going to go now to a listener in Eureka, Line 4. You're on the air with Mark Tushnet.
Thank you very much. In listening to your opening remarks, the thought came to me, and I realize it's not original with me, but they who control, define, or frame the issues really control the debates. And it seems to me that conservatives have been brilliant at inventing push-button phrases that get a highly emotional reaction, such as special rights when it concerns the idea of homosexuality and discrimination, more concerned about the rights of criminals than the victims, the term judicial activism, in a way, is brilliant because I have heard that so many times, but I think people just kind of spew it out in a rather rote kind of way without really understanding the meaning, the whole term pro-life. But as I just look at those buzzwords, I think they have pretty well succeeded in framing the issues around the whole idea of their promoting their agenda in terms of the courts and the Supreme Court.
I don't want to make a general comment.
I mean, with common, a lot of ordinary people, as I want.
Right. I wouldn't want to comment generally about Republicans' abilities to frame issues. I do think that the use of the term activism in general, without the label liberal activism, was quite effective as a criticism of the Warren Court, and it still continues to be effective. The problem is that once you have what I was calling conservative activism, the label activism doesn't help you or the public understand what the court's doing.
Mm-hmm. But it just seems to me that among ordinary rank-and-file individuals, I think the conservative movement has really succeeded in defining the whole debate the way they want it to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other side has been quite inarticulate and needs to do a better job of explaining. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. I think that we could probably say rhetorical strategies are important to no matter what your politics are. I mean, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And the conservative criticism of the Warren Court was quite effective in, as the caller said, framing issues for really almost a generation.
Yeah. Well, in your book, you write about, one of the things that you write about is what we've seen recently in terms of the Robert Bork nomination and the Clarence Thomas nomination and what Republicans and Democrats learned from that process. Maybe this would be a good time maybe to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. This is the other part of the politics of the judiciary. This is sort of the external politics. The first thing to say about it is that there's nothing particularly wrong with having politics associated with the nomination and confirmation process. We talk of ourselves as having a separation of power system, which means the courts ought to be independent, but we also think that we have a system that we call checks and balances, and the way the courts are checked and balanced is generally through the appointment process. So we do want politics associated with that process. The second thing to note is that what seems different about the Bork and Thomas nominations, and seems likely to happen with the next one or two nominations as well, is that there was large sort of interest group mobilization, grassroots lobbying, advertisements on television, of the sort that you see in ordinary or electoral political campaigns. That hadn't happened before. But the reason it hadn't happened is that politics generally had changed. In the past, Supreme Court nomination politics were backdoor deals, balancing interests of regions, and so on, in a way that making other legislative policy was. Today, politics in Congress is interest group driven, and so it's not surprising that you find interest group driven nomination politics as well.
Yeah. What are the constituencies that will mobilize for the next nomination?
Well, it's pretty clear that the two relevant constituencies are in some ways mirror images of each other. The issue on which it's clear that the Democrats are willing to essentially fight the most serious battle they can is the right to choice with respect to abortion. And on the other side, and they will mobilize constituencies, the organized women's groups, and liberals more generally. And on the other side, the conservative, the label is Christian right, which is devoted to a vision of overturning Roe and Wade,
and protecting the right to life, as they put it, will counter-mobilize, will mobilize in support of a nominee that they believe will contribute to the overruling of Roe and Wade.
Do you think concerns over the future of the federal judiciary played a role or a significant role or no role at all in the election of 2004?
My own view is that they didn't play much of a role. For the past several elections, Democrats have tried to use the threat, as they would see it, of transformation of the Supreme Court as a way of getting their voters to the polls. My sense is, although I'm not a real political analyst, my sense is that that hasn't been terribly successful, that other issues, the war on terrorism or the war in Iraq or the economy, have always been more important.
Are there ways citizens, groups, grassroots groups, can play a role in shaping constitutional law other than at the ballot box and lobbying Congress when it comes time for a nominee to be confirmed or turned down?
Sure. Now, it's not that individual citizens can do anything other than lobby or write letters to their representatives, but another pattern in our history is that when there are major social movements mobilized sort of in the streets or in the public generally, the court, by mechanisms that people don't fully understand, does turn out to be responsive to them. So the best example recently is the gay rights decision of a couple of years ago, striking down Texas's law making homosexual sodomy unlawful. 16 years before that, the court had upheld an essentially identical statute. Then it struck it down, and the only real explanation you can have for that is that over that 16-year period, the society became more comfortable with the idea of gay rights and gays as engaging in an acceptable mode of, maybe not desirable, but an acceptable mode of sexual expression.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm going to reintroduce our guest at this point here. Our guest is Mark Tushnet. He is the professor of law at Georgetown University. He's the author of A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. Our guest, Mark Tushnet, is Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at the Georgetown University Law Center. He earned his J.D. from Yale. He served as a clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, 1972-1973. He's the author of five previous books, co-author of case books and a course book. He's also the author of numerous articles and reviews. His latest book is A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. The book is published by Norton. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite your questions, comments this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. At the outset of the book, you tell readers that Justices Rehnquist and Clarence Thomas have laid the groundwork for a revolution that would truly reconstruct constitutional law, and that revolution has not yet occurred because of Justices Sandra O'Connor and David Souter. Where are we headed?
The way I put it in the book is that the Rehnquist Court brought the court to the threshold of really dramatic transformations in constitutional law, but didn't walk over the threshold. And we don't really know whether the next justices will decide to stay on the threshold or cross it and really change law dramatically. The changes that might occur would be in areas about the scope of Congress's power to
do environmental protection regulation, for example. These federalism decisions that I mentioned earlier could be pushed further than they have gone now to restrict Congress's power to protect endangered species, for example. It's also reasonably clear that these new breed Republicans are much more receptive to substantial government interaction with religion than was true 20 years ago. And the court has already upheld school voucher programs that involve religious schools. It will confront faith-based initiative programs, and it might even, you know, this is a speculation, but it might end up holding that if you have a voucher program, you have to include religious schools in it.
We have another listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and take this call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. You were the first thing you mentioned about ecology, and they might restrict Congress's ability to tell the states what to do in that area.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of economic pressure to that they're succumbing to, in my opinion, in that case. And there's a lot of economic pressure also to allow the military-industrial complex to throw us into wars overseas and things like that, in my opinion. And I was wondering, the one safeguard that was built into the Constitution that would hold people like Bush from getting us into foreign wars that weren't really relevant to our security is the idea that treaties are supposed to be the supreme law of the land. And however, I've never heard anyone relate a story or anything that would make the Supreme Court as champion of that idea, you know, and in holding back the executive branch from getting us embroiled in wars that perhaps, or even not just wars, but just actions that are against treaties that prior administrations have signed, that kind of thing. Could you speak to that at all? I'm just curious if I'm pretty sure Rehnquist would be like one of the last ones to get in favor of that. But you know, could you put it in perspective? As far as I know, the Supreme Court has always fallen down on this one particular issue.
Sure. Let me say a couple of things. First, you're absolutely right in saying that the Supreme Court has historically been very reluctant to intervene in cases directly involving war and military involvement overseas. It's sometimes got involved in some collateral issues, but on the core questions of whether it was within the president's power to deploy military force, the court has always stayed out. And there's no reason to think that that's going to change in the near future. The second thing is you mentioned Congress's power, the power to make treaties, and which is shared by the president and the Senate. One of the most interesting developments, again, from my point of view, at least as an academic, is a fairly recent movement among conservative constitutional thinkers to develop arguments that would say, actually, the Senate doesn't have as much power to make treaties as was previously thought, and maybe some of the treaties and legislation and implementing treaties that have been enacted are themselves unconstitutional. That's a real new development, and again, we don't know whether the Supreme Court will ever buy it. But one of the things that we've seen over the past generation is that ideas that circulate among conservative legal thinkers for 5 to 10 years eventually seep into Supreme Court decisions.
Is it possible to say something about what you think they may be trying to do in particular with that last thing you just mentioned?
Well, they're primarily concerned with what they see as the transfer of U.S. sovereignty from domestic lawmakers, that is, Congress and the president, to non-U.S. lawmakers, from the left, at least, the World Trade Organization, from the right, the United Nations or the World Court. There's a case pending before the Supreme Court now which involves the implications of a decision on a death penalty question by the World Court that would have some effects on whether Mexicans, in this case, could be executed in the U.S.
Mm. Well, I think that's typical because we seem to routinely deny full sovereignty to people in countries in this hemisphere, and it's we're just projecting that kind of thing happening to ourselves in that case. But anyway, thank you very much.
You're Thanks welcome. For the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited. You can join us with a phone call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. President Bush will very likely be making some appointments in his second term. I have a few questions here. Do you think the president will look toward moderate conservatives or new breed conservatives?
Well, it's pretty clear that his basic desire will be to nominate new breed conservatives. When he was campaigning, he made it very clear that he saying that the justices he most admired were Justices Scalia and Thomas, who are exemplars of that part of the party. And he'll want to do that. The real question is whether his political circumstances are such that he'll be able to pull it off. Those are the names that most aggravate the liberal Democrats, and they've made it clear that although they may not want to, they may not fight every nominee. If they find a nominee too extreme in their judgment, they're going to use whatever resources that they have. Including the filibuster, which would be unusual, although not unprecedented.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line one. I'm sorry, that listener has dropped off. Let's talk with the caller on line two in Champaign. Hi.
Hello, Professor Tushnet. I have a question to ask you. I know you clerk for an icon, in my estimation, Justice Thurgood Marshall. I am African-American. I want to ask you, based on your expertise in this book and any other books or writings you may have authored, how do you account for the drastic departure from the norms of Thurgood Marshall that have been adopted by Justice Clarence Thomas in terms of ideology?
Well, Justice Thomas says, and it seems right, that his just as Justice Marshall was shaped by his experiences, Justice Thomas says that he was shaped by his.
What experiences would justify an African-American being to the right of Attila the Hun in this country?
Well, what Justice Thomas says, I should make it clear, I did work for Justice Marshall. I admire him and disagree with Justice Thomas. But what Justice Thomas says is that in growing up, he experienced not merely... He experienced a combination of disparagement by sort of overt white racists and disdain from purportedly liberal whites. And he drew from that, he says, the conclusion that the best way for African Americans to accomplish full citizenship was basically on their own.
Now, let me ask you this, and I don't want to be rude. he has taken a very anti-affirmative action approach, along with Justice Scalia.
Right.
And yet, as I read anything I can get about this man, trying to figure him out from Pinpoint, Georgia, to where he is today, and I come from Camden, Arkansas, to where I am today, I find many instances where he was a beneficiary of affirmative action, including getting into the Yale Law School.
There's no doubt that he did benefit from affirmative action in that sense. That is, he was appointed to positions because of his race. Interestingly, when he first moved into the Reagan administration, he gave an interview saying eventually he wanted to be on the Supreme Court, and he didn't want to be appointed to a position that was clearly race associated. He did take one as head of, I guess, the civil rights section of the Department of Education before going to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. But one thing that he also said, he wrote this in his dissent in a couple years ago, affirmative action cases. He said, look, if you have an affirmative action program, the people who benefit from it, and he means pretty clearly like me, are always going to be subject to, you know, suspicious looks. You're not really qualified for this position. The only reason you got it was because of your race. And he thinks, and I agree with him, that that's inappropriate. I actually think that lots of people say that Justice Thomas wasn't qualified for the job when he was nominated in terms of sort of raw qualifications, and has not performed well as a Supreme Court justice. I think that's wrong. I think he was qualified when he was appointed, and, you know, although I disagree with him on lots of things, almost everything, I think he's performed well as a justice if you abstract from his political positions. And what he says is that the views that I've described as common ones result at least in part from the fact that he did, in your sense, benefit from affirmative action.
Okay, I guess there are other people waiting, so I'll let it go. But one substantive question about Justice Thomas, and that is, I know I'm always nonplussed about how this new Supreme Court, the Rehnquist Court, has read the 11th Amendment, seemingly moving from strict construction to whatever they want to enhance states' rights. I'm also concerned about Justice Thomas's opinions, albeit they're in the minority, assuming he would be Chief Justice because he's one of President Bush's favorite justice, along with Justice Scalia. His distorted or strange reading of the First Amendment in terms of restrictions on separation of church and state or the establishment. Can you sort of give me an idea of what he means, especially on that latter point?
Sure. What he said is this. In 1789, when the establishment, the non-establishment clause was put in the Constitution, what it meant was that the federal government, the national government, couldn't either establish a national church or interfere with there were three or four established religions in the new states. So it was, it didn't mean separation of church and state, he says, in the way we understand it, because the First Amendment would allow established churches in the states where they existed. Then he says, along came the Reconstruction Amendments, the 14th Amendment, which the court has said meant to apply the first eight amendments, free speech and non-establishment, to the states. He says that's a misunderstanding of what was intended by the 14th Amendment, that because the 14th Amendment, because the First Amendment, the non-establishment clause, was protective of state prerogatives with respect to religion, you couldn't really, in the terms lawyers use, incorporate it into the 14th Amendment. That's a position that had some respectability, academic respectability, about 50 years ago, Most academics who studied the issue think that he's probably wrong on both parts of that, more wrong about 1789 than about 1868, but it's a position that, you know, that at one point was widely held, and he's reviving it.
All right. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I've got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, you're invited to give us a call. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, constitutional law scholar Mark Tushnet, author of A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. To pick up on something that our last caller mentioned, how does the Chief Justice shape the court's jurisprudence?
That's a more complicated question than you might think. Formally speaking, the Chief Justice doesn't have much more power than any other justice. What they describe the Chief Justice as is the first among equals. He runs the court, and Rehnquist has been a tremendously effective administrator of the court, and it endeared him to his colleagues. He has, when he's in the majority, he has the power to say who gets to write the majority opinion. Chief Justice Rehnquist actually has not used that power terribly strategically. So as a formal matter, what the Chief Justice can do isn't all that substantial. What's interesting about Rehnquist is that he's been on the court since the early 1970s, when he was appointed by Richard Nixon mm-hmm. and then made Chief Justice in 1986, and he's, as an individual, articulated a forceful conservative position over that 30-some-odd-year period. So he, as the voice of conservatism, first basically alone and then being joined by others, stands for the kind of transformation of constitutional law that might occur after he leaves.
Hmm. You write in A Court Divided that Rehnquist came to the court fully shaped intellectually. Has his jurisprudence evolved over time, or did he come fully formed in that sense?
It basically hasn't changed. I know there's a sense that I've picked up in interviews that it's fairly common for presidents to be surprised about how their appointees turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Nixon would not be surprised about William Rehnquist. When Rehnquist was being considered for the appointment, Nixon was told that Rehnquist was the most conservative lawyer in the Justice Department, and it was a very conservative Justice Department at the time, and that's how Rehnquist has turned out to be. One example is that in his very first year on the court, he wrote a dissenting opinion. He was the only person, nobody else joined him, dissenting opinion saying, here's an example where Congress has gone beyond the power that it has under the Constitution. That was 8-1. Nobody else thought that Congress had gone beyond its power. Go ahead 25 years, and now you have 5 justices of the Supreme Court in a series of these federalism cases saying, yes, indeed, there really are limits on Congress's power, and they've gone beyond those limits. So he was consistent and, in some sense, succeeded more as an individual than as a leader of the court.
You know, the thing we're just talking about here, you know, so much has been made of how the responsibility of the job can change a justice. Is that at all true for anyone? In Rehnquist's case, not so.
It certainly happens to some people. The best example that of the current court is Justice David Souter. Justice Souter is a very smart person, very smart lawyer. He had been a state Supreme Court justice and actually had been appointed to the Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, but hadn't even sat on a case when he was named to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said that he had never confronted the kinds of issues that came before the Supreme Court. He just hadn't thought about the questions. So he was, he's worked out his constitutional philosophy in practice, sort of on the job. Now, that's very unusual. Most people, most nominees are more like Rehnquist, having had some background and experience than Justice Souter. But you do observe changes of some. conservatives have criticized Justices Kennedy and O'Connor, Kennedy in particular, for essentially playing to the liberal media, becoming less conservative because he likes to get his name in the newspaper. I don't think that that's a fair characterization of what Justice Kennedy has done, but they think that that's an example of a change, an undesirable change, based on experience on the court.
One quick question before we have to go. How many nominations might the president make, or how many seats might he have to fill?
Well, it's certain that he'll have the opportunity to fill one seat. I expect, as everybody does, that the Chief Justice will retire no later than the end of this court term, which is in June. His health may make it necessary for him to retire before that, but that position will be available. Almost everybody expects Justice O'Connor to want to retire a year after that in 2006. Beyond that, it's very hard to tell. Justice John Paul Stevens is 84 years old,
right.
And you know, he's in extremely good health, very vigorous. But when you're 84 years old, lots of things can happen to sort of knock you off your stride. And so, you know, if I were predicting, I'd say two, and then there are the accidents of life and health that might give the president a third vacancy to fill.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Professor Tushnet, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Mark Tushnet is Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University Law Center. His latest book, A Court Divided, The Rehnquist Court and the Future of Constitutional Law. The book is published by Norton. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. At the Chicago Board of Trade today, very quiet trade across the grains and oilseeds floors, narrow ranges, and a lot of zeros or unchanged to report to you today as we go through the final numbers on this Friday afternoon. March wheat for the day had a high of $2.91 and a quarter cents. Settlement price, or low rather, at $2.88 and a quarter. Now the settlement price, that at $2.90 a bushel. It was up a half for the day. The May futures unchanged today at $2.98 and a half high, low at $2.95 and three quarter. Settlement price there at $2.97 and a half. Once again, the May unchanged. July contract up 3 quarters for the day. 303 and a quarter, the high, or rather 305 and a half, the high, the low at 303 and a quarter. Settlement price there at $3.04 and three quarter cents, up 3 quarters. The September futures for the wheat pit now 311, the high, the low at 309 and a half. Soft red winter wheat settled the September contract at $3.10 and a quarter cents, up 3 quarters. December futures 320, the high, the low at 318. Settlement price at 318 and three quarters, and they finished up a quarter of a cent for the day. The March corn now, 196 and a half the high, the low at 195 and a quarter. The settlement price at 195 and three quarters, unchanged for the day. The May futures at 204 high, low at 203. Settlement price at 203 and a quarter, and it finished unchanged as well. July contract at 211 and a quarter high, low at 210 and a quarter. Settlement price at 210 and three quarters, they were unchanged. And the September today, unchanged, 218 and three quarters the high, the low at 218, settled 218 and a half. December futures at 228 and a half high, low at 227 and a half, and your new crop settled the December 227 and three quarters. They were down a quarter today. The March of 2006 corn contract at 235 and a quarter high, low at 234 and three quarters. Settlement price there at 235 and a quarter, and it finished down a quarter for the day. The March oats a 170 high, low at $1.68, settled $1.69 and three quarters, up a penny and a quarter. And the May oats a 159 and a half high, low at 157 and three quarters, settled at 159 and a quarter. They finished up one.
March soybeans for the day. 517.5, the high, the low at 512.5, that 5 cent trading range settled in the middle. 514, down a penny and 3/4 for the day for the March soybeans. May futures, 515.5 high, low at 511.5, settled 513, down 1. And July futures, 519.75, the high, low at 516.5, settlement price at $5.18 a bushel, down 0.5 cent for the July. August contract in the bean pit now. 523, the high, the low at 520, settlement price $5.21 1/4, down 0.5, and the September futures, 524, the high, the low at 522 1/4. They settled at 522.5. They were up 0.25. November beans for next year, up 0.25 cent for the new crop, 533.5, the high, the low at 530.5, and a settlement price up 0.25 cent for the November soybeans, 531.5. March bean meal for the day, 155.20, the high, low at $154 even, settlement price at $154.10. They were off 80 cents. And the May meal down 70 for the day, with a settlement price at $153.80, a high of $154.70, the low there at $153.50. Bean oil, the March contract, $19.51, the high, the low at $19.22, settlement price at $19.24. They were off 19 cents. And the May bean oil, a 1965 high, low at $19.38, settlement price there at $19.39, and they were down 19 for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Mostly higher day today on the Merc. March feeder cattle, $100.80, the high, $99.67.5, the low, $100.22.5, the settlement, that up 32.5. April, $100.20, the high, $99.20, the low, $100.05, the settlement, that up 40. May, $99.45, the high, $98.65, the low, $99.40, the settlement, that up 35. February live cattle, 90.15, the high, 88.70, the low, 89.77.5, the settlement, that up 52.5. April, 88.40, the high, 87.10, the low, 87.67.5, the settlement, that up 2.5. February lean hog, 74.65, the high, 73.50, the low, 74.15, no, make that 74.12.5. The final price today for February lean hogs, that down 7.5. April, 75.80, the high, 74.30, the low, 75.30, the settlement, that down 2.5. May, 76.15, the high, 75 even the low, 76.07.5, the settlement, that up 15. June lean hog, 78.25, the high, 77 even the low, the settlement, 78.15, that up 22.5. February bellies, 94.70, the high, 93.40, the low, finishing at 94.37.5, up 30. The Dow off 70 points at 10,397. The NASDAQ down 19 at 2029. The S&P 500 down 7 at 1168.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Judy Adams from Detroit, Michigan sends this poser. Dear Dr. Science, do